This is WHFR Dearborn. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our public affairs show here at WHFR.fm, the station making waves. We believe, and we know you really believe it too deep in your hearts, that the most important things are those that, well, happen right next door. Not necessarily literally, but, you know, on your block, in your city. And you know it's true. That if you know what's happening in your local community and you decide to do something about it, which means you decide to give a call to your city councilman, to the mayor, write a letter, send an email even locally, that has a big effect. You know, the power of one, especially when there's only so few in a city or a county, that means a lot, and it can get a lot of things done. I've seen it time and time again at Dearborn City Council meetings and Dearborn Board of Education meetings that one person stands up and raises an issue other people hadn't thought about, and oh boy, things happen. Things can happen. So thank you for being with us for this hour. Today is June the 27th, 2008. And I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, our WHFR news director and also producer of the show, Susan Morrell. Good morning, Susan. Good afternoon, Susan.
Good afternoon. Our show has moved to 1 p.m. in the afternoon, and it's very hot and muggy out there in southeastern Michigan today, if you happen to be listening online.
And you haven't gone out yet.
From another location on WHFR.fm.
I was interested. I got a call this morning from one of our WHFR alumni, former news director, in fact, and he lives in Dearborn now, and they're without power on the east side of Detroit. So that little squall that hit yesterday afternoon, I was in Fairlane Town Center, and it was beautiful blue sky, clear at 10 to 5, and by 5:10 still inside the town center, the skylights got black, and I looked outside from one of the exit door areas, and it was just squallish, you know, downpour, like you're inside of a waterfall.
Yes.
And that lasted for about 15-20 minutes, and apparently there was some outages. Now, I don't understand why, but last night it was about 9:30 or so, my power went out briefly in East Dearborn. The person I'm talking about who didn't have power this morning was also in East Dearborn, and my power went out for about 30 seconds, which was scary.
Well, that's true. It did. It got very ugly here in Metro Detroit. And my understanding is that storm did a great deal of damage over there in Sterling Heights. Tore up trees and dumped trees on houses and cars and all kinds of major damage.
Well, I, in my recollection, and of course my mind is failing me these days, but I am quite old and go back a few decades, I don't remember a storm, even a brief 20-minute squall that got so dark and so windy coming up so fast. That was just amazing. And of course, I didn't take my umbrella into the town center, so I got drenched coming back out to the car. But
Jay, have you noticed that we've been having these storms for about the last month? They're drifting in and out on a weekly basis.
And who knows if it's global warming or just cyclical, but I don't remember this kind of rain and blusteriness in the past, but it's just maybe the trend that we're going through now. Who knows if it's global warming?
Well, I think the trend is we're getting the offshoot of all the heavy-duty rains and tornadoes in the mid part of the country over in Iowa and Missouri, and they're and under major flood damage, and they've ruined all the farmland, and people are out of their homes, and It's a terrible disaster to our farmlands, and it's going to be our food supply and people's lives.
But we dare not exaggerate and cause fear and panic, right?
Well, I mean, when you see people underwater and the whole town is underwater, nobody can get to their house, I think that's pretty serious.
Okay.
But it hasn't happened here in Michigan, here in Michigan.
Let's turn to the local news that we might be able to more control, folks. We talked about local news being somewhat more controllable or more able to be influenced anyway. And so I'm grabbing the Sunday Times from the local area, just taking a quick look through there to see what we might want to delve into more deeply. Sunday Times is the Dearborn Times-Herald publication that covers a wide range of downriver communities surrounding Dearborn, and also features one of the 30-plus-1 columns of Frank Buick. He's giving a plug to a new advertiser in the paper, and he loves their product. And, of course, we don't do those plugs because we don't need advertisers, so we can save your time there. What did come up, and I wanted to make other comments about, especially because it's in the Wednesday Press and Guide editorial. That's right, they actually wrote an editorial themselves. And that doesn't happen often, folks, so I want to read that. But Susan, you and I talked about this, too, and it might have been on the local news. I think it was in a scandalous way. The FBI raided the city of Dearborn. Okay.
Oh, that's what I heard.
That's right. Now, that's the brief headline story, is that the FBI raided the city of Dearborn, raided Town Hall. And, in fact, it wasn't anywhere near that. First of all, there was an investigation going on, as I understand all these stories, in the city about a person, an employee of the city working in the, I'm almost going to say, infamous building and safety department, since there have been certain questions and issues related to the power and the application of the power of that particular department in the city. But in any event, a city employee, they suspected as falsifying performance bonds in exchange for bribes. Okay? Now, that was forwarded by, we're told in one story here, Mayor O'Reilly himself to the Dearborn Police for investigation. They turned it over. They said, well, that's a federal issue, and I'm not sure why that is, but performance bonds in exchange for bribes were some of the bribes from out of town. Somehow, they turned it over to the FBI. And the FBI, first of all, went and raided the employee's house, that is, confiscated, you know, any evidence that might apply to this suspected, alleged illegal activity. And then they came to this person's office in the building and safety department. So that was the FBI raid. In effect, the city had asked them to come and investigate, and that's what they did. They didn't come, and you know, I don't know if anyone there actually knew they were coming. That defeats the whole purpose. This employee might have had friends or something that might have destroyed records. So they would want to make it kind of a surprise to the other employees of building and safety if they weren't the ones that initially uncovered this this potential bribery, okay, and fraud. In effect, I think that's the right term. However. Okay, Now, let's see. And I thought, you know, that I would come on and at least just comment on just to get the record straight, is that the city was on top of this and did know about it. They're the ones that found out the suspected crime, which apparently went back 3 years. Huh. Yeah. This is supposedly this went back 3 years of illegal activity, if true. And so I thought, well, I know how the Detroit media, the TV stations would portray it. In other words, FBI raids Dearborn or the Dearborn City Hall, and that would be an exaggeration and quite unfair to the city. Well, okay. Here's what Tim Powers, who is the editor of the Press and Guide, said in this Wednesday, June 25th edition. Again last week, Mayor Jack O'Reilly's administration demonstrated it is failing in its stated attempt at openness and communication, particularly with the press. There had been a problem with honesty and money handling in the Building and Safety Department, which city officials say they discovered, initiated an internal investigation by Dearborn Police, and then turned over to the FBI. When the FBI searched the department office on June 12th and then questioned the employee involved, city officials suspended her without pay on June 16th. Then they sat back and waited for the explosion of media coverage. They knew it had to happen when people at the FBI and the federal courthouse, where the warrant for the search was obtained, began to leak the information that an office at Dearborn City Hall had been searched. Yeah, we have people that know the media well enough to know that that was going to happen. And even I know, on a non-commercial station, how commercial media and news goes after this stuff. If it bleeds, it leads. If it's sensational, if it makes people shocked and amazed, oh boy, it's going to be covered, even if they have to sort of slant the facts and exaggerate and drop off some details that aren't as much fun. And so that's what happened. Maybe the city thought, well, nothing's going to happen. It's all been taken care of. The woman's been suspended, and the FBI did their raid, and oh my gosh. And then it hit the commercial news media in Detroit, and it made the city look bad, certainly. Tim Powers goes on, the administration did not get out front and tell the public an employee in one of the city's most visible offices had been suspended for alleged wrongdoing. They did not come to the local media and say, quote, look, we have a problem, but feel it is isolated and not harmful to the public. The problem is being investigated and new procedures are being established to make sure better checks are instituted at Building and Safety. That's what they should have said, according to Tim Powers. And they should have done it before it hit the media that there was a raid and blah, 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 and it might look like they were covering something up by not even trying to, you know, issue a press release about it. Tim concludes, Tim Powers, again, editor of the Dearborn Press and Guide, in this week, June 25th edition, that would have been a great move, generating comments from the public about the city's leadership and image of taking charge and solving the problem. Instead, he said, we, meaning the Press and Guide, are getting comments about the continuing image of the department and the city's lack of candor. He says, I, Tim Powers, had a very positive feeling when O'Reilly took over, but incidents like this are shaking that feeling. And, of course, the buck stops at the top, so he can talk about Mayor O'Reilly there, but I would say the folks in the public relations department, someone, maybe they didn't even know about the raid themselves, someone should have written the press release that appropriately made that very simple and direct statement. Hey, we have a problem. We found out about it. We put it out for investigation. We suspended the person. Of course, it's interesting to me, it took them 4 days to suspend this employee without pay. 4 days after the raid. I mean, what sort of procedures? They had to have committee meetings for 3 days before they could decide to suspend the person without pay until this was resolved. You know, I don't know about that.
4 days is a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I question that. But even after the suspension, they didn't issue anything to the press, and they should have known it was going to be picked up and then exaggerated or, you know, slanted against the city.
Sounds like they were trying to keep it quiet.
My last comment on this, and then we can go on with some of your stories, Susan, that you have there, is... what it made me think of, about the Building and Safety Department over the years. In three of the last four of Mayor Guido's, our previous mayor, who did pass away a year ago, but three of his four last state of the city addresses. Specifically said, and you know, they're not that long, folks, but it specifically said there are problems in our building and safety department, and we're going to work them out. We're going to change things. We're going to get to the core of it, and we're going to make changes. Now, it's interesting, in his last State of the City address, he didn't say anything about building and safety. But my understanding is there haven't been significant changes. Now, what do I know about it? I mean, otherwise, if there were, somebody would have issued a press release. That's what I'm thinking. Unless the previous situation was so, I don't mean illegal here, but corrupt and crazy, that they wouldn't have admitted they even let it last until that point at which they made the change. In other words, sometimes you want to give the impression it's always been good, and the fact that you might have just done something to make it really good or a lot better, you don't want to even talk about that. You want to continue the impression that, well, it's always been really good. And I think most of the offices in the city of Dearborn have been doing a very good job. As I've said about Mayor Guido and Mayor O'Reilly, it's a general conclusion. It's an image thing. What do I know about the details? I only know what I read in the paper. But this was troubling to me, Tim Power's comment, because first of all, they don't usually make an editorial, don't usually write an editorial. And number two, it means that there's a lot of other people that are making comments to the paper about why this takes so long. So I think they learned their lesson and something will change. And if there are some of these problems with building and safety that I've heard comments about, and if they are continuing, not just this one employee and the one bribery thing, they got to get to it quick. But I thought it was amazing to me that Mayor Guido tried for 3 years. It was one of his priorities, three of his last 4 years in a State of the City address. And to my knowledge, there was no press release, no information that anything ever changed. So what is going on in that department? Who really has the power? And what's holding this change back if it was so needed and recognized by, in three of his last 4 years, Mayor Guido? Interesting point, and I bet we're going to have more stories about this following
so
up on that.
So what is your final question to the mayor of Dearborn at this point?
I don't think he's to be criticized here. Somebody did find out this was going on, and he was the one that took the initiative to communicate with the police to investigate it. And it's just that he should inform, make sure that his public information officers, and they have a team there, that they, number one, should get the information, and they should relay it to the press in that very succinct and careful way before it breaks in other media, and other media will exaggerate and distort it. They just have to make sure that happens from now on. They can't just say, well, it's unfortunate, we took care of it, and nobody else needs to know about it. No, it's too easy for people who are looking for hot news to talk about, you know, City of Dearborn raided by the FBI or something like that. I don't know how exaggerated it got, but it could have been that bad. So there you are. Okay. By the way, they do, and we do want to thank the Dearborn Press and Guide, although it's kind of buried in the college corner here. The college corner, internationally known artist to perform local benefit concert, and then it's continued on page 8A, and it mentions Henry Ford Community College, and then on page 8A, it mentions that it's our non-commercial radio station, WHFR 89.3, the station to which you are listening, that is presenting, along with Trinity House, we're co-sponsoring it, if you will, Brian Vanderark, not here at Henry Ford Community College, but at the Arab American National Museum. That's tomorrow night, June 28th. Doors open at 7:30, 8 p.m. We've been running the spots for him. Bill Wright played some of Brian Vanderark's music during his big band show, even. And we hope that's going to be very successful. But unfortunately, they split the story, and they started it as if it is an artist that's performing at Henry Ford Community College. They don't find out until they turn the page, and a lot of people don't turn the page to read the rest of the story. It's hard to find sometimes. That by golly, it's us, WHFR, which is part of Henry Ford Community College, but we have our own funding that we have to raise. And it's not here at the college. It's at the Arab American National Museum, okay, Michigan Avenue near Schaefer. So we hope we're going to see you all out there. It's going to be a great concert. Brian Vanderark and the folk duo Ellery starting off the show.
And what time?
As I said, doors open at 7:30 and it starts at 8 o'clock.
Okay,
and it's a great sit-down, folk concert in a, what I'm told is, and I'm sorry I haven't been there, we've done some events there, but I haven't gone over there before, a wonderful, comfortable venue, very classy, and soft drinks and beverages will be provided for a small fee, not by WHFR, but by the museum management. There's no food that will be served, however, so have a big dinner before or go out afterwards.
Okay.
And it's, since it's two artists, it will run probably from 8 to about 10:30, maybe 11. Or 10:30-ish, anyway, something like that. So it's going to be a great evening, and all the proceeds, since the artists are doing it for free, minus the museum room rental fee that we have to pay, all the artists are doing it for free, so we get most all of that money coming to us, and we really always need your support and appreciate it so much. Story that you have right on top of your list, Susan.
Well,
what did you want to share next?
The issue of the day is gas prices, and I know we've been talking a lot about that here on WHFR. You were talking about it last week. There's an article from in the Detroit News from Thursday, June 26th. It's called "Trickling Down," that higher oil costs are forcing an increase in prices of everyday consumer goods, and that more than half of a typical 42-gallon barrel is used to yield gasoline and fuel. The remainder goes into chemical products such as pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, and pesticides, as well as plastic for creating packaging goods such as groceries and toiletries. Now, here are some of the everyday products that are petroleum byproducts, and the prices are going to rise because of the price of fuel. One of them would be prescription bottles for prescriptions, golf balls, plastic storage containers, razors, toothpaste, and pet food. I mean, it's an odd assortment of products, very, very odd. But as we notice, the prices that we pay at the store for everyday items, including food, are going up on a weekly basis, and the price of gas is going up on a daily basis. And I came across a very interesting editorial on the internet. This is from CNSnews.com, a cybercast news service. It's a commentary by Terrence Jeffrey, and the title is "The Threat to the Car." And he says, I'm going to just paraphrase some of his statements. He has a philosophical view about what is happening. He says, the automobile use is declining in America because of escalating gas prices. And this is worrisome for those who love liberty. And Jay and I are great lovers of freedom and liberty. Jay is a libertarian. And he says,
by definition, I have to love liberty, right? I
mean. Right. And he says it's in keeping with the American spirit. The automobile is in keeping with American spirit, and cars and trucks are privately owned, and they enable us to go where we want when we want, and that cars and trucks are freedom machines. And some liberals, he says, liberals would like to use government to force Americans out of their cars. I do not agree with that statement. He says that liberals believe in socialized transportation, not free market transportation. I've never really heard those phrases before. He says liberals are in favor of socialized transportation and free market transportation. I don't think that makes sense.
If a good reliable bus line is socialized transportation, I love it. I mean, I've been in my favorite city for a bus line is Austin, Texas. It only costs $1 for a pass that you can use all day long, go anywhere you want to, 30 miles east, west, north, south. It's on almost every street, and the buses come regularly all the way through the night, every 10, 15 minutes. Come on, what's wrong with a community service like that?
Well, here's what he says. He says, in a socialist transportation system, the government takes the taxpayers' money and purchases vehicles that would be buses or trains, and this is by a government-funded agency, and decides where and when these vehicles go, and it's determined by government where and when the vehicles go.
And And I have to respond to that, is that supposedly this is a democracy, and that unlike private industry, where we have no public input, okay, I mean, we can write letters, but they don't have to listen to them. They can do anything they want to. Government supposedly will listen to you. If you vote for the right people, if you continue to communicate with them and actively participate in campaigns to influence government in a positive legal manner, then you can get one. Now, to force everybody to use buses, no. But for those that can't afford to have a car or who just don't want the hassle of it, it's a wonderful, wonderful convenience to have a good system, and we don't have that in the city. So you can, you know, throw out that nasty term socialism and call it a bugaboo, or turn it, you know, that as all the conservatives like to do, or liberal or whatever. Let's look at the reality. Okay, forget about the term. Look at the reality. A true conservative would want the maximum amount of personal freedom, and it's true that everybody's money, in through taxation of one sort or another, would have to go into a good bus system. But I think it's money well spent. On the other hand, as a libertarian, small L at least, libertarian, as our forefathers were, all four of them. Okay, that's a joke. Well, but our forefathers who, you know, in the Revolution, you know, with Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, John Adams, and others, Alexander Hamilton, when they wrote documents like the Federalist Papers and others that supported and recommended and argued for our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, they were all in favor of giving people a lot of choices. You know, but it's government by the people, for the people, and sometimes, not all the time, people decide that they want some collective help and support, like an army to defend the country, okay? And there's other examples. I would think public education should be another example, that we need that. We still depend on that. Thomas Jefferson thought it was totally essential for the government to assist and direct that, maybe not run it. And so we have to balance these things.
All right, so here's the other part of his argument. He says, in a free market transportation system, a person travels solely in the company of people with whom he has freely chosen to travel. Mm. In a socialist transportation system, a person may be compelled to travel in the company of people he does not know. Oh, and that would be so scary. And those people could be even be a danger to him. Well, I am really not that scared of
this person. Better not go out to shop at a shopping mall or something, because he might actually be in the same aisle or a grocery store with people he doesn't know.
Every single public transportation system I've ever been on, and especially subways in Washington, D.C., in Toronto, I have loved it. I loved it, loved it, loved it. It was great. So here is what else he says. He says, Americans who love the freedom of movement that they derive from owning and operating a car or truck will recognize the efforts by the various levels of government to induce them to stop or limit their driving and compel them to leave the free market transportation system and submit to the socialist transportation system.
The emphasis are those of Susan Morrell, WHF News Director. Remember, these opinions are not necessarily ours and not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College. She was reading with emphasis, satiric emphasis, I might say. But that's a good statement of that one extreme point of view, and I do say it's an extreme point of view.
But let me just go on with this. He says the governments do this by placing constraints on parking availability. They restrict certain highway use. You must carpool, or you must ride a bus, or imposing excessive gas taxes or road tolls, or using excessive revenue to subsidize money-losing public transit. I mean, he's really covering all the bases here. He says, now here's his final argument. He says, artificially suppressing the oil supply is the most significant method government is using today to move people from a free market transportation system into a socialized transportation system. That our government is suppressing the oil supply right here in the United States. And he says we should drill our own oil now. We should drill it now in the places where it can now be drilled. So that's his argument.
I saw on The Daily Show last night, you know, John McCain last year clearly was against drilling on the offshore areas around the U.S., and he made statements about that's the wrong thing to do. It'll take 10 years or more to have any significance, and even then, I mean, it's feeding the addiction we have. It's taking us in the wrong direction. Short-term, we won't see that oil short-term. It's not going to affect the price of gas even when we get it, which might take 10 years before it starts coming in. But now, of course, McCain has turned around and said, oh, he's all for it. It'll help us short-term. Well, it will not help us short-term, folks. Listen to the scientists. Forget about the politicians. Listen to the people that actually know something and are not into it for a political advantage. So I'm afraid this gentleman, like the opinion on Fox News and other conservative things, is not very well informed, my opinion, in terms of the science of the issue.
But Jay, what he's saying is, what about the leases that the oil companies already own? Yeah, they own thousands and, and thousands of acres of leases by the government. They're not drilling. What about that? That's his point.
Yeah, and the oil companies say, well, that's just sort of a backup plan, but that's going to be very expensive to get that particular type of oil from those areas, even though, yeah, it's available right here in the U.S. In other words, they already own the land. So it's not a matter of, you know, that's got to make it a lot cheaper than trying to ship it from and paying people in the Middle East for it in the first place and ship it all the way across the ocean. But they have their arguments.
But the big argument now is the oil in the Gulf of Mexico that they want China to come in and drill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, as I said last week, and I know you listened to that show.
I did.
Know you did.
I did.
I said the four-syllable word, and it's not a nasty word. It's called conservation. A little bit of conservation, a little bit of planning by all of us can get us all out of this short term pretty quickly, but everybody has to do their part to conserve, and that is the fastest and easiest way to do it. Now, for some people, they see it as a hardship that they can't drive as often or as much with their car. But other people are taking an active part. It's not just a negative thing. Well, we've got to cut back. We have to eat less. You talk about food prices. We have to drive less. We have to go fewer places. No, you don't have to. And coming up in the last 20 minutes of this show, and that's only 9 minutes away now, just warning Susan here about this, I have a special interview I recorded 2 days ago with the first instructor here at Henry Ford Community College to buy an electric car. And I know you love electric cars, right?
Oh,
Susan?
I do. Love,
or at least
love.
The principal.
Love.
Well, he doesn't have what might be called a real full-blown electric car, but he's driving an electric car in every day, 19 miles to the college and back. And we want to hear his story. And this is something people can do. It's true, the car cost him $8,000 new. Okay. And some people can't afford to get a new car even at $8,000. Okay.
Well, I want to know where he bought it.
Well, right. We give all that information in the story. So we're going to try as much as possible here to give you some alternatives. Now, certainly, if you can walk, if you can take the bus to work, if you can, or to shopping, or if you can use a bicycle, find out how to do that. Be safe. Be sound about it. But explore these other options. They will save the United States. They will pull us out of this mess so fast if everybody can do their part.
Yes, but Jay, please address this issue. We do not want China drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Please answer that.
Oh, duh. Well, Gulf of Mexico, you mean beyond territorial waters.
Well, I mean, we don't want them over here drilling. I mean, isn't that our territory?
Well, no. I mean, every country controls, I don't know if it's 20 miles or 100 miles, but we have a territorial limit. We can control the offshore drilling up to that point, and that's sort of agreed upon by, in most cases, international law. Some people dispute if it's 100 miles or 20 miles. But if it's out in the ocean somewhere beyond that, then China, anybody, United States, anybody can go and get that. So I don't think, apparently you took this from a Fox News Channel story or something?
Well, I just have heard it around, and that's what Jeffrey is talking about.
I've not seen that China's going to get our offshore drilling rights instead of us.
Well, maybe that's a rumor. I don't know.
Since we owe them almost $1 trillion now, we took out loans, to do the Iraq war, I think they can sort of threaten us to do anything they want. And that would be totally inappropriate, but I'm saying we are so deeply in debt to them, they're going to control us in a few years in terms of suggesting that the interest rates are going up on those loans or whatever, besides of their massive investment in this country in terms of owning businesses and industry and so on.
Well, the whole thing is a very scary scenario. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll get some intelligent leaders somewhere. I'd like to bring up this story in the few minutes we have. This is from the Free Press from Wednesday. This is a total surprise, but voters are going to be asked in November to downsize Lansing. Now, we had talked about different petitions that I knew of that were started by the voters. Listen to this one if you haven't heard it. The GOP says that the Democrats are going to gain in this petition to cut leadership. A sweeping revision of the Michigan Constitution that would cut state politicians' pay and benefits where it doesn't eliminate their jobs altogether came out of nowhere in recent weeks and appears to have a realistic chance of making the ballot in November. The lengthy and complicated proposed amendment would overhaul much of the state's political structure, including the hyper-partisan process of drawing legislative district boundaries, which I've railed against for years, and so have even some of our elected representatives around here. By coincidence or design, many changes appear to come at the expense of Republicans, especially in the judicial branch. 8 of the 9 judges who would lose their jobs, including 2 Supreme Court justices, came out of the Republican Party. So you've got to be very suspicious of this, folks. First of all, it looks like it's going to get on the ballot because the Dems, who happen to be right now controlling the House and the governor's office, they look like they can get this passed. And a lot of people do want legislative reform. That most people's impression of our legislature, and there's an editorial in either the Times Herald or the Press and Guide from someone, not from the paper, talking about it's been the worst year for the Michigan legislature ever in terms of what they've done or haven't done. Okay, but
I agree.
Well, okay, in general, most people feel that way, whatever the specifics are. And this plan, though, I think we should be very suspicious of. There's 5 points, and I'll try to read them real fast. In 4 minutes, we have our special interview with our electric car driving professor. Yes. Okay, here's the highlights of this plan proposed by the Democrats, and it'll probably pass, we think, and it'll be on the November ballot, even though other initiatives for like a part-time legislature and to end the term limits, which almost everybody agrees these two things should probably happen, that's not going to happen. See, so what is the Dems have done a preemptive strike here if it happens, and people will probably vote for it because it seems like it's cleaning up, you know, government, but it comes from the government itself, so that's always very suspicious. Here's the main points, and we'll cover this more, and you have to decide about it in November, probably. Number one, cut the pay of the governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and state lawmakers by 25%, and the pay of all state, county, and district judges by 15% in 2009. Well, I don't know what they're making now. Can they survive? Will they have food for their children? 25% pay cut for the biggies and 15% for the others. We'll ask Gino Polidori if 25% pay cut is too big for him. And whether or not he's voting for this. It'd be interesting to see. Cut the state, he must have already, went through the House. Cut the state Senate from 38 to 28 members and the House from 110 to 82. If we went to a unicameral, not bicameral, but a one-House system of government, which has worked in some other states, then you would automatically, of course, reduce the number of people. And can you get more things done with fewer people? Yes, certainly in committees. A committee of 4 can get a lot more decided and worked out than a committee of 12. That's or 18 or 22. And so that might have some value. Require financial disclosure of the assets, income, and other information by elected officials. Don't we have that now? We sure need that. Prohibit lobbying by retired legislators for 2 years. Oh, the poor babies get no money for 2 years. And then they come back like a lion. And no, they shouldn't be allowed to come back at all as lobbyists. That's my opinion, folks. But this doesn't go far enough. Downsize the Supreme Court from 7 to 5 members. I don't know what the point of that is. I really, other than saving money. And the State Court of Appeals from 28 to 21. Other than the Dems wanting to get the Republican appointees out of there, you know. Add 10 judges to the... Oh, wait a minute. We vote on them for the Supreme Court, don't we? That's not appointed. We vote on them, and it's by parties. So if there's fewer of them, And there's more Dems in the state than you would have to cut some out. But you add 10 judges to the circuit courts. Now, we know that's needed. Circuit courts are overloaded. They need some more judges there. Redraw districts for the smaller legislature, and hopefully they redo it not on party lines so much, but on other more logical things, like the whole city of Dearborn should be represented by one person, not split in half. Oh, my God.
I read that the whole thing, the whole scenario is going to be in favor of the Democrats.
Well, it is. Yeah, because they're the ones in power right now. Why would the people in power vote for something that would hurt their power? That you would never do that. That's the first law of politics, is you never do anything that would hurt the power that you have. You only do things that would gain you more power. Now, some of these issues, though, seem well-intended and might have a good purpose, but I don't think any of them go far enough. So I'd be very suspicious of this. And it's too bad I haven't heard that. We won't know for another 2 weeks whether or not any of the citizen petitions, citizen-begun petitions, and citizen-initiated petitions will get on the ballot for things like, downsizing government. I haven't heard about one for that.
But this is downsizing government, Jay.
The fair tax.
This is downsizing proposal. Government. I think it's very it's a big downsize.
It is, but it's doing some things that that may not go far enough, too. So,
well, it's a good start.
That's why I said we're going to look at it. And, we want you to be aware that it might be out there, but always be suspicious if it comes from those in power.
Well, I'll vote for it.
Well, she doesn't know the details, but she's going to vote for it.
No, but okay. I mean, already it sounds good.
Okay.
It sounds good.
Well, now it's time for that interview, so we're done talking.
Go for it.
Sorry, here it is. My interview that was done on the Wednesday.
I want an electric car.
Okay. We're in the studio today with Tom Waldemeyer, Henry Ford Community College philosophy instructor. And he that's a wonderful career, and he does a fine job. He has the office next to mine in the Fine Arts Center here at Henry Ford Community College, in fact, so I keep tabs on him on a daily basis. And as I was have been noticing the last few months, he's been getting a lot of attention around the college, and he is the first faculty member to drive an electric car to the college on a regular basis. So I want to introduce him to you folks and hear about how this all came about. And this is part of our constant alternative information on the new WHFR Journal about alternative ideas, and some of which may be even better than what we have now. Welcome, Tom.
Well, welcome, Jay, and thank you for having me on the show.
Always happy to share new ideas. You own an electric car and drive it back and forth every day. So a lot of people here at the campus have seen you park it in the faculty lot, and so all kinds of people that almost accost you in the hallways and saying, "Tell me about that." With the cost of gasoline these days, they suspect that the car is pretty economical. Let's just talk about that right now. First of all, how much did this particular, and there are many different electric cars, and we'll talk about what research you did, but this particular car cost you how much money to buy?
Well, the base price of this car was approximately $8,000.
Mm-hmm. And it's a two-seater?
It's a two-seater.
Okay. And how much does it cost to run it in terms of gas? Well, duh. In terms of electricity, can you calculate that at all?
Well, they say it's like the cost of recharging the battery, since I use it 4 days a week coming to the college on Monday through Thursday. It's about like running a refrigerator. And so you're really talking a couple dollars a month or $3 or $4 mm-hmm. a month for recharging it overnight.
I've heard, not that I know anything about this, and it could be a totally different kind of electric vehicle, and because there are many different kinds out there, that the cost is about 2 cents a mile, and that certainly compares favorably with over $4 a gallon of gas, and most cars getting 20 miles to a gallon, let's say favorably, hopefully 20 miles to a gallon. Mm-hmm. Most of them get 15 or so, but certainly a gallon doesn't go as far as it used to. So that's still much less expensive. What just on the cost issue, what about insurance for the insurance cost?
Well, I added the cars to my insurance policy. It was a little bit less than a regular sedan. So you do have insurance. Because it is a street legal car, I have to have insurance. I have a registration from the state. It has a license plate. And all the safety requirements, headlights.
Seat belts?
Has seat belt. It has all the things that are needed because it is street legal.
Of course. Okay. And so whatever, you know, some people there, depending on where they live, they might have higher or lower payments for their any car that they might have.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. And what do they tell you about the longevity of the batteries? I've read about that. Do you have to put out maybe $1,000 in 2 or 3 years?
Well, now, they've told me the batteries will last for years. These are, it uses 6 12-volt gel batteries, which are basically lead-acid batteries, which are not as expensive as, say, lithium-ion batteries and so on. So they will last for a number of years with a lot of cycles of charges.
If properly maintained. Again, there's some rules, and we'll talk about the things you have to keep in mind when you have an electric car. But it is true. In fact, I remember even in the days when I taught batteries as a big deal, because it was there was major issues. Lithium ion are a little bit easier to take care of, but they are much more expensive. And when I was teaching video production here, in the olden days with lead acid and NiCad batteries, they would even say about the NiCad, the rechargeable batteries, that if properly maintained, they could last forever. Duh. It's just most people don't. They forget every now and then. They don't charge it up, or they leave it charged down too long, or they overcharge it, and there's all those things that can affect that. But lithium ion, I don't know. I do know that Toyota Prius, when people buy one of those, after about 3 years, they give them tremendous deals on trading them in, so that they never have any bad PR about the expected cost of replacing all those batteries in their hybrid, which it's not totally electric, but that's the way it goes. Well, how did this all get started? How did you get into that? You've had the car now a couple of months, but you did some research, as any good educated person will do. How did you get started thinking about this?
Well, a couple of things got me started. One was the this course I teach in science, technology, and society, where we talked about the transportation technology and automobiles, and that's
right. That's a philosophy class, folks. Yeah, it's one of those special philosophy classes. We have all the basic ones, you know, logic and history of philosophy and ethics, but that's a special class that you offer once every year or so, something like that. Okay, just so our folks know about that. Henry Ford Community College, all kinds of philosophy classes here.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you were talking about science and
right.
technology.
And we talked about those, and that's when I did some research for the course and found out that at one time, about 100 years ago, there was a booming electric car business, even in Detroit. And that, in fact, there were electric cars, there was the internal combustion engine, and there were steam-powered cars, and for a while they were about equally selling. And then things changed because of a number of reasons. But anyway, that's what got me started, and then I found out that there still were electric cars being made today. And I also heard about a particular vehicle, the Tesla Roadster, which was a really high-powered new electric vehicle that is very expensive, but had such a performance figures, 0 to 60 in less than 4 seconds. And so I really got interested in electric vehicles. And so doing research then on the internet, finding out what was available, it soon became clear that there were 2 or 3 options that were economically feasible for commuting.
Yep, in the area. In fact, we're talking today here on this special pre-recorded segment of the new WHFR Journal with Tom Wallemeyer, folks. If you tune in a few seconds late, who is our lead teacher in the philosophy department here, and teaches philosophy full time here at Henry Ford Community College, and his electric car. So, was it just a cost issue for you?
Well, and I will say this, when the price of gas spiked up and went above that $3 mark and so on, I said, I'm going to think seriously about this. Because on the average, if I commute every day, I am saving about a tank and a half of gas, which may be like $60 or $70 times 4 weeks. I'm probably saving $280, $300 a month.
How far away do you live?
I live 19 miles from the campus.
Okay. So it's 38 miles each way. And that's
correct.
That may be somewhat typical. I mean, most people, I understand, are unfortunately not able to live close to their work. In fact, I know I'm quite rare. I live only about, 3 miles if you take the roads, but as the crow flies, only about a mile and a half away from Henry Ford Community College. Not that they'd have a path directly to make it easy for me, but most people do have to drive 20 minutes to half an hour or more in for the daily commute, and unless it means they're getting stuck in traffic or something, that's one reason. Maybe it takes some of them a little longer, depending on the time of day they have to drive in. Okay, we probably should tell people some of the negatives here. The car you have for $8,000 is not equivalent to everybody else's car in a couple of major ways that people should keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the differences are, of course, it is smaller, although it is it's a regular size car in the sense of how it fits on the street and so on. It's not a tiny car, but it's not as long as a regular car. It's a two-seater, although it's made by Chrysler. It's called a GEM, and they have four-passenger and six-passenger vehicles also.
Mm-hmm.
And the model I have is a two-passenger, but it has a little, it looks like a small steak truck. It has a little bed on the back.
Yeah, like a little small version of a pickup truck.
That's correct. So I can carry things. I can carry the total payload is up to 600 pounds.
Right. And if you had two passengers and you subtract that weight, but still that means that outside deck, you could get a couple of good bags of topsoil on there.
Yes,
if not 10 or 20,000 bags of potatoes, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know, not that much. So the size is an issue for people that might be used to large cars, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But again, for licensing, it does pass its own highway safety standards. I guess the real problem that we were talking about before is the range, though.
Mm-hmm.
Before it needs to get its batteries recharged, it can only travel
far? The range is about 30 miles on a charge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did want to speak to that if I could.
Yeah.
I have found by analyzing my patterns that unless I'm going out of town, I don't travel more than that distance anyway. That it's at the most, the farthest I go is the 19 miles to school. If I go up from Royal Oak to Pontiac, that's only 12 miles. If I go to the CVS, that's 3/4 of a mile. If I go to Kroger's, that's only 1.5 miles. So if you look at your patterns of traffic, most of the time you don't drive long distances. Of course, I have to say, I guess, I have a regular sedan I use if I'm going on long distances.
Yeah.
But I have found that most of the time now, my regular internal combustion sedan sits in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of my traveling around is short distances or distances where I know where I'm going.
Right, right. And, of course, it should be obvious to our listeners that if the range is 30 miles and it's 19 miles to get here to, you said, to the college, that you can't get back home without a charge.
That's correct.
And what did Henry Ford Community College do for you?
So there is an outlet in one of the parking spots where I can plug in and recharge to give me enough electricity to get back.
And you had to make a special request for that, didn't you?
Yes, that's right.
We don't, sorry to say, folks, we do not have electrical outlets in all the parking lots, or any of them, except for Tom's. And does this have your name on it or something, or something that only Tom can use it? Or?
No, it doesn't. Not,
not,
right
not
now.
Yet. Okay.
And I would say, though, that I mentioned that driving an electric car has a tremendous benefit for the environment in the zero production of greenhouse gases. And I think since Henry Ford Community College is interested in doing environmentally favorable things, they were favorable to this idea because of that.
And I think in the future, too, this is an urban area. And as you know, if just by looking at the maps, you can, because this, besides the range, the other issue is that I'm not sure if we made clear before, is the maximum speed of your car. And maximum speed is maybe 30 miles an hour at best. And it's not licensed to go on any street where the maximum speed limit is above 35. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right. So you had to carefully look at a map and figure out what streets are residential or at least semi-residential that would be 35 or under.
Right. And that was really quite easily. There's many streets in the area that are have 30-mile-an-hour limits or 35-mile-an-hour limits. So I was able to pick a route that actually was quite scenic. I might say I enjoy my commute here now, whereas in the past it was just a chore. And now I'm taking some very interesting streets, and it's kind of quiet driving. I enjoy it quite a bit.
And your commute with your sedan on expressways at the same time of day would be, what, 30 minutes?
Well, no, it used to be between 30 and 45, and now it takes me an hour. So, although today was only 55 minutes, so I would say it takes me about 15 minutes longer.
And yet the stress factor is not there, is it?
The stress factor is not
there. It's not these high-speed, braking, maneuver, avoidance, they really take a burden, I think, on us in society, and actually traveling slower. They did a joke on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show on cable TV last night, showed that the future transportation may be a guy on a bicycle, and Jon Stewart was acting as if he was getting sick, because he was getting motion sickness from going so slow. But of course they do satire to exaggerate that this is actually very relaxing. And actually the bicyclist they showed was smiling, because they can actually enjoy the time in the transport. And so you don't have any horror stories of people that have tried to run you off the road?
I have had no horror stories. Everyone I've encountered has been favorable, waved, as they've asked a lot of questions. How can I get one of those cars? Where do you get them from? And I've got all kinds of favorable comments, and actually no negative ones. Since I drive on the streets have a speed limit of 35 or less, people know that they're not going to have to speed and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's always another lane. They can always go around me. And it has not been a problem at all.
Mm-hmm. How can people get more information? It took you a couple of years of going on the Internet. The Internet is a great source for this sort of thing because you won't find it in the Yellow Pages.
That's correct.
And a lot of people don't know about it. Obviously, on the Internet, if they use Google or ask.com as their search engines, they would just type in electric vehicle or electric vehicle manufacturers, or there's a variety of things. You have a website or two that you can remember?
Well, there is an Electric Vehicle Association of America, EVAA. There's a number of other electric vehicle forums that you'll find. You will also find even some electric cars available, say, on eBay and other types of websites like that. But there is quite a few. I have in my favorites, I must have 15 electric vehicle websites that I go to check regularly. Mm-hmm. And they'll give you the latest information on what's happening, what's available, and so on.
And people could always get in touch with you here, but we don't want to flood their mailbox necessarily. Mm-hmm. But you could look that hfcc.edu. Tom Wallenmeyer, his email address is buried somewhere in there if they really want to get
That's
in touch
correct.
With you.
I would be happy to.
Your dealer in particular, which was the only gem dealer in the area, was out in Fowlerville. Do you remember the name of that Chrysler?
That's correct. That was the Dick Scott Motor Mall.
Dick Scott Motor Mall in beautiful Fowlerville. Okay. And I did research just for our listeners, and I found out that that there is actually a manufacturer. Now, the gem is actually built somewhere
in North Dakota.
North Dakota, yeah, not in Michigan. In Michigan, we actually have an electric car manufacturer, American Electric Vehicle Company. American Electric Vehicle Company, and apparently they built their first electric car in Ferndale. You knew about that.
Yes.
You heard about it, but then they sort of disappeared for a while. Well, they now have a factory, and I've seen pictures on their website, out in Wixom, right by one of the Ford factories out there,
yes.
Lincoln Mercury or something. And but I discovered that the only official dealer in Michigan of this, and the car that they're currently featuring is called the Current. That's K-U-R-R-E-N-T. Sort of looks like Tom's car, by the way. It has a nice roll cage, and the one I saw was a two-seater. Interestingly, the dealer is in Traverse City because they sell them to and rent them to tourists that arrive at the train station, or just it's downtown train station in Traverse City, Michigan. And so if you just want a car for the day to go all around, it's more expensive than a gasoline-powered rental in Traverse City. However, the city of Traverse City passed a rule that There's no charge. You don't have to worry about putting money in the parking meters. Their whole town, you know, set up for tourists and that. Parking meters everywhere. Always got to have quarters available, but not if you got an electric car. Got an electric car, no need to put money in the meters. You can go shopping. You can go to the beach up there. You can drive all around, and it's very similar in its range and speed. Again, it's not intended for the major highways above 35 miles an hour, but it's built in Michigan, you know, and it's a start, you know. And I do know that if you look up American Electric Vehicle Company on the website or Dick Scott Motor Mall. I'm sure that you can get to their website and find out more information about one or the other. And both of these are very similar, but they're like the first steps in the electric car, alternative car revolution or evolution. And it won't be right for everybody all the time, but for a lot of people, especially in Detroit, golly gee, folks, it wouldn't take that much longer to, if you can afford to get a new car, $8,000 to $10,000. The current does start at about 10 and goes to 13, so it's a little more pricey depending on the options you want on it. So that's still a chunk of change, but when you consider how much you save, and maybe the fun you get out of it too, and a chance to be on WHFR maybe. Huh?
Yes, some way to get fame. I would say this too, Jay, that there are a lot of these electric vehicles around that people don't know about. Out where I live in the next city, Birmingham Police Department bought one of these GM cars.
Okay.
And and I'm not sure if you know, but there's a lot of factories that use electric forklifts, different kinds of electric trucks. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of electric vehicles out there. They just people don't realize this, how economical and how serviceable they are.
Well, hope we're giving people who are listening to our show some ideas about possible savings and a new way to enjoy their life. And Tom Waldemeyer, you're to be commended at taking that first step and being on the bleeding edge, although you haven't cut yourself yet, I don't think. Be careful out there. But, I mean, how bad can an accident be at 25 miles an hour?
There you go.
No, but keep wearing that seatbelt for me, please. And thank you for your time today.
Glad to be here, Jay.